Chapter 17. Boarding Action. "They're in," said Beltane, over the vox. "Contact reported." "Begin cutting," Gaunt ordered. The artificers nearby had been poised for the order. The blessed engine of the ugly Hades breaching drill thundered into life, and the oily beast, like some giant Promethean beetle from the lightless depths beneath some world's rocky crust, was coaxed forwards. Its heavy tracks clattered on the deck plates of lateral 16. The Hades was a siege engine, a boring drill designed for sapping and trench warfare. Gaunt had seen the engineers of Krieg deploying such devices to great effect when he was still a cadet. Cutting through what amounted to the hull of a starship was not a conventional use, but it was the quickest and most expedient way in that the tactical planners had been able to devise. The Hades's huge cutting head, a four-part breaching instrument of interlocked, diamantine-tipped, rotary power cutters, was mounted on the front of the tank chassis and adjusted by a powerful frame of piston drivers. The power cutters bit from the outside in so that the shredded material passed into the maw between the cutters, down a conveyor belt that ran through the middle of the machine like a digestive tract, and was ejected as spoil through the rear. Seen front on, the Hades resembled the grotesque, concentric mouthparts of some deep-sea suckerfish, with rows of teeth surrounding a funnel throat. Deep in that throat, above the belt, was a melter cutter positioned to weaken and blast the target solids into consumable slag. The chassis snorted black exhaust fumes. The cutter bits were spinning at maximum cycle. The operator triggered the melter array and fired several searing blasts into the skin of the reach. The skin began to buckle and deform, filling the hold space with a stink of pitch and scorched metal. Then the whizzing teeth bit in. The noise was painfully loud. It was the shrill scream of a high-speed drill, but mixed with a deep throb and roar of bulk industrial machinery. The heat blasts had softened the hull skin enough for the grinding, rending drill heads to find purchase. Hull metal wailed as it was abraded away. Fine scrap began to tumble out of the belt ejector, shavings polished almost silver by the rotary teeth. Fine dust and smoke rose off the power cutters, which were already superheating from friction. The crew members, standing by, unlocked their pressure hoses and began to spray the advancing head with jets of dank water. The Hades operator still applied ferocious heat using the melter because it was essential for the hull fabric to be soft enough for the teeth to bite. But it was also essential to keep the power cutters cool enough not to fuse and, more importantly, damp down and emulsify the clouds of microfine, ultra-sharp spalling that was coming off the cut in clouds like dust. If that got into eyes or throats, if that was inhaled into lungs, it would kill a man through catastrophic micro-laceration. The cooked mineral stink was bad enough. Occasionally, a flaw or imperfection in the hull fabric caused a large shard of debris to splinter off and be flung out by the spinning teeth. These pieces pinged and cracked off the protective screens and baffles. Gaunt knew what the ghosts behind him were thinking. It sounded exactly like small arms fire spanking off trench boarding. One of the operators was struck by a piece of flying debris. It knocked him off his feet, but he got back up again, bruised and shaken. A few seconds later, another operator was hit by a sharpened sliver that went clean through his body armour and into his torso above the right hip. Colleagues pulled him clear, but he was already bleeding out by the time they got him to the hold doorway, where the Medicaid teams were waiting.
"How thick?" Gaunt yelled over the howl of the drill. "Density scans show just over 3 metres," replied the chief artificer. "Time? Unless the composition changes, 18 minutes. "How long?" asked Durr, shouting over the scream of the Hades in lateral 39. 28 minutes, replied the head of the artificer crew.
"Strike Beta reports a significantly lower estimate than that," said Major Pasha.
The artificer's face was half hidden by a grimy protective mask. "The alloy composite in this location is appreciably harder," he explained. "I have compared assay reports from the lateral 16 cut. There is 9% more duracite in this location."
Major Pasha looked at Dower.
"We'll be through when we're through," she said over the noise of the cutting.
He nodded glumly.
"What are you thinking about?" she asked. "Alpha," said Dower.
They emerged from the Caestus into a racked, unstable atmosphere with flames leaping around them. Several huge fires blazed through the core of the engineering depot, and sections of the roof were collapsing because of the entry wound made by the boarding ram. Some form of fuel oil had spilled from a punctured tank and covered the deck. It was alight, like a field of bright corn, yellow flames and the reflection in the black mirror of the oil. Edwine, Holofernes and Saraf strode through the fire, heedless. Their antique, crested helms made them seem especially tall. Their ornate and bulky armour gave them an even more unnatural bulk. Flame light glittered off their gilded pectoral eagles and their barred faceplates and sparkled off their massive half-aquila boarding shields. All three had their bolt guns in their right fists, drawn up to rest on the right-angled corners of their shields. They began to fire as they advanced, gaining speed, moving from a stride to a bounding jog. Bolt rounds banged out, destroying sensors, auto-defence units, potential items of cover. Spent shell cases tumbled in the air. Behind them, the Caestus was disgorging the rest of its cargo, the weapons servitors. Two were tracked units with multi-laser mounts. The other four were perambulatory units, burnished silver and chrome in the colours of Edwine's chapter. They had faces of etched silver wrought in the shapes of skulls, or at least the skulls of angelic beings. Their upper limbs were weapon mounts, autocannons, heavy bolters, rocket launchers. They came through the lakes of fire as obliviously as the space marines, advancing like reaping machines through tall crops, blasting as they came. Energy beams seared down the length of the depot space, and bright tracer shots stitched the air. Terek 810's directive scans had already identified the three access points at the far end of the chamber and fed them to the space marines via their visor displays.
"No human biotraces in active opposition," Terek 810 reported over the Vox link. "Several hundred detected trying to flee the chamber. Several dozen more detected beneath debris or rubble, fading."
Almost immediately, as though the pilot servitor's report had been tempting fate, the boarding force started to take fire. It rained down from a steep angle, bursting off boarding shields and the polished chrome work of the gun servitors. Saraf took one kinetic blow across the side of his helm from a glancing shot that was hard enough to make him grunt. Terek 810 was dismayed.
"Auspex does not read human biotraces in opposition," he declared. "It does not have to be human to want us dead," replied Edwine.
He brought his shield up like a pavis and fended off the rain of the barbs. The other space marines did the same. Saraf noted the context of the impacts, the shrapnel marks and cuts, analysing instantly.
"Flechette rounds," he said.
They sourced the origination, post-human eyes hunting the dark for muzzle flash up in the chamber roof, up the dense framework of machinery and gantries.
"Movement." "Loxatl,"
Edwine reported. He had clearly glimpsed one of the long, sinuous Xenos reptiles. The other space marines didn't reply. They were too busy trying to kill the creatures. Terek 810 adjusted the parameters of his Auspex scan to include the xenobiological element.
"Holy throne of Terra," he breathed. The Luxattle were pouring into the depot chamber via the ceiling vents, squirming down the girderwork and vertical struts, using their four grasping limbs and their tails, firing the murderous flechette blasters strapped to their bellies. The Auspex already showed 68 of them, and the number was increasing with every passing second. The assault ships of Strike Alpha followed the Caestus's headlong rampage into the heart of the Reach. The outer hatch of the reassigned primary target had been disintegrated entirely. The Arvus and Falco craft had to close up and enter one or two at a time to avoid the jagged tatters of metal framing the mouth of the eviscerated docking bay. Decompression had stopped, so the air was free of flying debris. Generator fields had been re-established to seal the bay entrance, and each troopship juddered as it popped the field edge and entered the contained atmosphere from hard space.
"Stand by,"
the lead pilot sang out. The main docking bay was a disaster area. It looked as though a flash flood had sucked through it, washing debris to the mouth in a deep sediment of jetsam. The debris included whole landing ships and shuttlecraft. The flash flood had been followed by a firestorm that had left most of the space ablaze. There was no way to set down. The Arvus pilots were following the tracer signal from the Caestus. It had punched through into the next chamber.
"Thrawn, are we there yet?"
groaned Rerval. The inner dock was little better. The landers dropped speed again, circling towards the back of the chamber. The Caestus had smashed through into yet a third chamber. But this breach was too small and treacherously sharp for the thin-skinned lighters to risk navigating.
"Sitting down," the pilot yelled over the comm.
The first Arvus dropped on its thrust fans, wing profile adjusting for landing. It landed with a bruising thump on the buckled, debris-littered decking. The rear hatch dropped. Kolia, his rebreather up over his face, led the first squad out. He carried his Laz rifle and a tall, oblong boarding shield that looked like the lid of a coffin. It took him a moment to get his bearings. It had been dark and cramped in the back of the utility lifter. Now it was bright, glaringly bright, and the space around them was vast, a primary-scale docking facility. The air was almost freezing cold, but the heat from the various monumental fires scorched his skin. Machines and cargo handling rigs, destroyed by the Caestus's raid, lay in their wake. Other ships were coming in through the smoke wash and setting down behind Kolia's lander. Rerval called out and indicated the source of the Caestus's tracer signal. Up ahead of them, there was another puncture in the wall, like a giant bullet hole where the Caestus had gone through into the next compartment. Kolia ran forwards. Underfoot were burning scraps, lumps of debris and splattered organics from the dock personnel mushed by the pressure shock of the Caestus's strike. The puncture was big, but the lower lip was 4 metres off the deck level and the edges were still glowing red hot. Getting through was going to be entertaining. Kolia looked for a hatch they could force, a blast door, an air gate. No time. Nothing in sight.
"Storm it!" he yelled. "Grab some debris for scaling ladders! Move your arses! Living forever is not an option today!"
His squad broke away and gathered up sections of fallen gantry, dragging it over to the puncture. More sections were catching up with them, deposited by the next few landers. Baskerville was among them. Kolia saw the concern in his eyes through the lenses of his breather mask.
"We've got a problem," Baskerville said. "The breach? Screw that! The landing! There's no space!"
Kolia assessed the options. There were now 6 lighters on the deck, and space for perhaps 3 more. The Falcos and long bodies coming in behind would soon be stacking up with no room to land.
"We have to get the empties up and away,"
Kolia yelled to Baskerville.
"Agreed! Get the message through to the pilots," Kolia ordered. "They have to make room on the ground once they've discharged their complement, and the incomers have to make room in the air to let the outgoing pass through the dock area and get clear." "We can't keep them on station," said Baskerville. "No, we can't," Kolia agreed. "Good thing we plan on staying here, huh?" Baskerville headed back towards the landing zone. Kalia joined his assault squad at the puncture. Under the supervision of Derren and Cowber, sections of smouldering metal wreckage had been dragged up to the wall and hoisted to form makeshift scaling ramps into the puncture.
"Is it safe?" asked Kalia.
Derren just laughed.
"I know," replied Kalia. "Stupid question!"
He lifted his boarding shield and clambered onto the tubular frame, going up hand and foot. As assault commander, he wasn't about to let anyone else show him how it was done.
"Come on!"
he yelled at the men behind him. Most of them seemed particularly keen to help hold the debris steady.
"You heard the Major?"
Commissar Fazekio yelled, arriving at a run from a transport. "Get up that ramp!" The ghosts began to swarm up the girders behind Kalia. Kalia reached the summit and gazed through the massive tear in the compartment wall. He could see the fires burning in the depot space beyond, feel the backwash heat. He could see the space marines across the vast floor. He could see what they were blasting at.
"Oh, holy gack!" he said. "They're fettin' well waving them off!"
Costin exclaimed, his voice sounding dull and stupid inside his rebreather.
"Look at them! Baskerville's just waving them off!"
Merrin looked. He saw what Costin was talking about. E Company had just begun to deploy from their Falcos, and the landing zone was packed about as tightly as anyone would ever want. He could see Major Baskerville and some of the other company officers signalling empty landers to lift off and clear the debris-strewn deck to make room for more. That meant if they needed to pull out in a hurry, there wouldn't be enough transports waiting.
"Gag! That's just great!" snapped Gendler.
"I know! Fethin' marvellous, right?"
Costin agreed. Gendler didn't reply. Merrin pretended to be too busy shouting at some laggards to get down the ramp. The truth was, Costin wasn't their best friend right then and there. Just before load-up and launch, he'd come to them, shit-scared about something Ron had said. The pathetic idiot had just dumped it on them, right in the middle of the pre-combat build-up and the stress that brought with it. Costin was a liability. He couldn't handle a thing, least of all his drink anymore. He was paranoid and raving. Best guess was Ron had somehow sniffed out a trace of the sweet little deal they had been running. If that was true, then it sucked like a chest wound. It didn't suck quite as much as the assault run they were now in the middle of. But in the long term, provided there was going to be a long term, it could potentially suck even worse. If they did know, things could turn very ugly for Merrin and his close confederates. As ugly as Costin's face. What had he done? What had the drunken shithead managed to do? How had he given them away? Loose talk over some sacra? Some dumb slip? Whatever it was, Merrin was sure of one thing. They had Costin. Rowan wouldn't have gone to Costin if he hadn't known for sure Costin was in it. Otherwise, it was probably a fishing trip. Costin was probably all they had, because only Costin was stupid enough to give himself away. And even then he wasn't stupid enough to blow the whole thing. Ron was baiting. Ron was counting on Costin being so panicked he'd do anything he could to save his neck. And he would. Costin always would. So if they made it out of the Reach alive, Merrin had some serious damage control to manage. The rain of fire from the Xenos became torrential. Flechette rounds detonated all around the advancing space marines in razor bursts. Edwine felt ultra-sharp splinters slice off his armour. One actually punctured the ceramite. He felt it dig into the meat of his thigh. The sheer shot rate and penetrative effect of the Loxatl blasters would finish them. Even three of the Adeptus Astartes would be brought to their knees, and then their deaths by such a deluge. His shield was still up. Sighting down his bolt gun, he began to blast up into the roof space, blowing out rigs and gantries.
Debris rained down. He saw one writhing reptile body tumble and burst on the deck. Scans now showed close to 180 Luxattel flooding down into the chamber. Some were racing down the chamber walls to attack from the ground. Edwine directed the fields of fire of the weapon servitors as they pushed forwards in the face of the onslaught. A large adult Luxattel launched itself off an overhead gantry and dropped onto Holofernes. Dew claws extended to slash. Holofernes caught the animal on his shield and smashed it aside. It bounced off the deck, rolling, its blaster harness torn so that fleshette ammunition scattered loose. Switching around, Sar Aff put a single bolt through the Loxattle's skull before it could rise. Its brain matter splattered across the deck and its massive blue-grey trunk and tail went into muscle spasms. Another leapt. Sar Aff blew it in half in the air. A third came down. Holofernes had clamped his bolt gun and drawn his spear off his back. He threw himself forwards to meet the close combat attack, decapitating the third Luxattel with his circling spear blade.
Ithaca!
The iron snake yelled. The next Luxattel to come at him lost its front limbs at the elbow joints in one fluid slice. The one after that died from an impaling wound. The next, which attacked this Holofernes, was ripping his spear out of his previous kill, had its back broken by a backhand smash of the iron snake's boarding shield. It was something, but it was only a start. Auspex now showed 271 Xenos contacts in the chamber. There were so many coming down the roof pylons, they were pushing the front runners off the handholds, forcing them to drop, claws out, onto the space marines. Sar Aff slugged them out of the air with bolt rounds, blowing open skulls and rib cages, severing whiptails, showering the fight zone with meat and viscera. Then, two flechette rounds hit his right shoulder guard almost simultaneously and drove him down onto one knee. Terek 810 raised the Caestus into the air behind them, ramps still gaping open. He got the damaged craft up to about 8 metres and swung it in over the heads of the advancing space marines. The armoured bulk of the Caestus formed a hefty shield, soaking up the majority of the blaster fire that had been raking the space marines and their servitors. In its shadow, Edwine saw that the deck plates were peppered and grazed by the fleshette fire to such an extent they resembled a lunar surface. The deck was also littered with bloody Xenos meat and slimy plum-coloured organs. Fleshette fire raked the Caestus. Luxattel dropped onto it, leaping down onto the hull booms, gripping onto the ragged wings. Some fell. Others clung on. They swarmed over the upper surface. Terek 810 retracted the open ramps, but several of them had already slithered inside, like lizards skipping across a rock in the sun. He could hear them skittering and chirring inside the vacated compartments. He could smell the stink of rancid milk and crushed mint that oozed from their flesh and breath. Another animal scrambled up the hull fairing right in front of him and started firing its blaster point blank at the little armoured window port in front of the pilot's position. After 8 frenetic shots, the armoured glass actually began to craze. Terek 810 switched to manual control and began to swing the Caestus around. The increase in thrust sucked air into the atmospheric intakes, and the Luxattel on the fairing was dislodged. It ripped past him, claws squealing on the metal, shrieking an inhuman scream as its tail and one hind leg vanished into the intake. Terek 810 could hear the Luxattels already aboard, breaking through the compartment hatches under his position. The sickening stink of bad milk grew stronger. He adjusted the ram attitude again, tilting it more steeply, trying to train the Magna Melta on the gantries overhead. He got a decent angle.
"Cover yourselves," he voxed.
Below the ram, the space marines backed off, shields raised. Terek 810 had enough power in the heat cannon for 3 more decent shots. He fired. Part of the overhead girderwork exploded, and droplets of molten metal rained down. The Melta blast
torched Luxattle into blackened, shrivelled shreds that roasted off the gantries like scraps of burning paper. He fired again, a huge section of the roof gantry, on fire and covered with burning Luxattle, fell away and glanced off the ram on its way to the chamber floor. The creatures on board were in, right below him. They had torn open the compartment hatches. They fired up into the roof of the stowage bay, and razor shrapnel from the flesh-out rounds burst through the floor of the pilot's position, shredding Terek 810's legs and groin. He felt the ice pain of tiny, hypervelocity metal shards travelling up through his torso, bursting organs, severing augmetics, and liquidising blood vessels. He felt them in the sacs of his hearts. He felt his lungs collapsing. Blood filled his throat. The Luxattle, underneath his position, chattering and squealing, kept shooting, blasting shot after shot up into the pilot's position. With his last double heartbeat, the pilot servitor triggered the afterburners. Kolia's eyes opened wide. It was one of those sights he would never forget. He'd seen some things in his life as a guardsman, seen some things before that too. This was a new brand on his memory. He saw the Space Marine's boarding ram, the Caestus, damaged and blackened, crawling with Luxattle. He saw it tilt, nose up, pointing at the tangled, complex ceiling structure of the depot chamber, a structure that was dripping with Xenos. The Luxattle were spilling out of the roof space like maggots out of bad meat. Kalia was at the top of the makeshift scaling ladder, poised on the lip of the puncture hole. His men were behind him, yelling at him to go on, jump down, make way for them. He had to stick out his hand to steady himself. The ragged metal lip of the hole was hot.
"What can you see?"
Rerval was yelling from the girder behind him.
"Major, what can you see?"
He could see the tilted Caestus, engines pulsing, a writhing mass of Luxattle across its upper hull, some falling off, tails lashing. He could see the Space Marines and their weapon servitors on the floor of the chamber below, blasting at the grey reptiles as they rushed in from all sides. He could smell rancid milk and crushed mint.
"Major!"
Kalia watched as the Caestus shuddered. It fired up at the ceiling vault, bringing down huge chunks of machinery in showers of flame and sparks. Burning Luxattle dropped like comets. It fired again. A massive pylon cylinder broke free of its ceiling mount and came crashing down, strung with fracturing gantries and doomed Luxattle. The huge structure, streaming smoke and flames, barely missed the Caestus as it fell. It hit the chamber floor so hard that Kalia felt the shockwave shake the girders he was standing on. It almost crushed one of the Space Marines, the towering Silver Guard, Edwine. Edwine hurled himself full length to avoid the impact. He landed in the midst of recoiling Luxattle and immediately had to kill them to protect himself. The pylon cylinder toppled after the impact and fell on its side with a second crash that kicked up sparks and a blizzard of burning scraps. It rolled, burning. The Caestus was almost overwhelmed, its afterburners lit. The rockets roared with scorching white heat. Laden with Luxattle, the ram accelerated up into the roof. That's when the real shockwave came. Kalia felt it in his lungs. He felt it punch his ribcage. He felt it hammer the deck and the compartment walls. He felt it knock his legs away. The Caestus tore into the vault, triggering a vast fireball that ripped through the ceiling structures, destroying them. Macerated, burning Luxattle were hurled in every direction. The expanding fireball, a rolling wave, lapped out across the ceiling of the vault and down the walls. Falling, Kalia felt the heat of it. Wrecked, but essentially still in one piece, the Caestus fell back out of the roof, bringing the ceiling down with it. Energy crackled and sparked like lightning around one of its twisted engine sections. A ramp door tumbled off. The air was full of flames. The collapsing wreckage hit the chamber floor with a numbing crash. Kalia hit the floor too. The blast had smacked him off the girder into the depot chamber. He jumped up, dazed, gazing at the devastation ahead of him.
Major! Major Kalia, respond!
Rerval was yelling over the link.
Get in here!
Kalia yelled back.
C Company, get in here now!
He raised his weapon and ran forwards. Behind him, ghosts were leaping in from the rim of the puncture. Edwine got up, throwing wreckage aside. Aloxatl reared up at him, and he killed it with a headshot.
Status!
He demanded over his helmet link.
Alive!
The voice of Saraf snapped back. A vox crackle. Holofernes didn't answer, but Edwine knew that was because the Iron Snake always had something better to do. Edwine could see him, 30 metres away across the piled and burning rubble, fighting at close quarters with a dozen of the surviving Loxatl. Holofernes's spear circled and stabbed, killing them one by one, leaving arcs of Xenos blood in the air behind it. According to Edwine's visor display, they had lost one of the gun servitors, crushed under the fall. Regrettable, but an acceptable loss. He activated his helmet's vox record.
Note for posterity,
he said, turning to dispatch another pair of lunging reptiles.
The selfless sacrifice and attention to duty of...
Edwine paused, shooting out the spine of a leaping Loxatl. He couldn't remember which ancient pilot servitor had been assigned to the Caestus for the mission. It would be on file. He would amend the citation later. Edwine clambered forwards. 2 flechette rounds punched his shield. He turned and fired a bolt round that detonated a Xenos head. Ahead of him, beyond the strewn wreckage, he saw that the white scar had made it to the far exit of the depot chamber. Cunning and shrewd, Saraf was always moving, always looking for a path. They were Loxatl all around the old bastard. Edwine ran a couple of steps and leapt off a pile of steaming scrap metal. Despite the added weight of his revered boarding armour, the bound cleared a significant distance. He landed, leaping again, and came down a short distance behind Saraf. As he made this second landing, Edwine cleared 3 targets with killshots. Saraf turned, smacked a Loxatl aside with his shield, and stamped in its neck to kill it.
You moved ahead, said Edwine. We cannot cover each other if we are too widely spaced.
There are matters to attend to,
Saraf replied.
They will not wait.
They will wait forever if you are dead, replied Edwine. The creatures defending this site are reacting with surprising speed to our attack.
If your throat is cut, said Saraf, it does not matter how fast you react. We must get on and cut the throat.
Sometimes there was no arguing with brothers of the fifth. Holofernes, still locked in close combat behind them, seemed determined to methodically kill every single arch-enemy in Salvation's reach, one by one. The White Scar, however, appeared quite content to leave them all standing, provided he could cut ahead and decapitate their command structure. Both were respectable combat ethics. They were entirely incompatible. That was why Edwine had charge of the mission.
We move ahead, he said. We stay together.
Saraf nodded. Edwine activated his helmet link.
Strike Alpha Lead to guard formation. Are you deployed?
Confirm lead.
Who speaks?
Major Kalia, Tanith First.
Where are you, Kalia?
Scaling the breach now, advancing into the depot compartment.
You need to close the gap. We are pressing forwards. Be advised, a high density of Loxatl mercenaries are present. Are you familiar with Loxatl, Major?
Yes, lead. We are just a few minutes behind you and progressing rapidly.
Very good. Lead out.
Edwine and Saraf turned to the hatchway. The White Scar had just finished 2 more Loxatl. Alien blood spattered his pearl-white plate. Charges took out the hatch. In a fog of blue smoke, Saraf and Edwine advanced, shields raised, bolters propped over the right-angled corners. Holofernes was closing at their heels. They moved into a hallway, a main accessway. There was blood and wreckage on the floor where personnel had fled the ram strike and sealed the hatch behind them. The structure and age of the walls and ceiling and the machine components fixed into them was such that it looked like the corridor had been built from scrap, cannibalised from several different starships. Shots started to snap at them. Holofernes had joined them, his spear at his shoulder, his bolter back in his fist. They formed a line, three abreast, shields up, a moving wall, resilient and formidable. They advanced, almost filling the corridor from side to side. The gunfire smacked into the rigidly held shields. It wasn't Xenos fire from some exotic fleshette blaster. It was last shot. Up ahead, the first human defenders appeared, blasting down the smoky corridor with las rifles and hell guns. Shields up, the space marines walked into it, blasting as they came. The mass reactive rounds streamed away from them and cut the hallway apart. Bodies fell, wall panels blew out, parts of the ceiling caved in. The firefight exchange grew more intense. The space marines didn't slow down for a second. The ghosts of Strike Alpha pushed forwards across the depot through a jumble of burning debris. Zukova reported that her company had engaged with some Luxattle and were in the process of subduing them, though the bulk of the Luxattle force had been wiped out by the space marine spearhead. Kalia wondered if there would be more. He wondered what other wretched things lay in wait in the junk habitat. He heard the heavy .30 crank up and start to fire. Bull and McCann were getting busy. What the gack had they seen?
"Hostiles!"
Cowber yelled over the link. The scout had pushed forwards to the left-hand edge of the chamber. Kalia hefted his shield up and started to run. The shields had barrel slots cut in the top right-hand corner of their shapes so the wielder could carry the shield in his left arm and brace the weight of his las rifle barrel across the slot. Effectively, he could fire from behind cover. Kalia hadn't used a boarding shield in combat before, but they'd been training hard en route. He still believed they were cumbersome and ineffective. He was running forwards with five or six other ghosts, leaping blazing debris. A crippled Luxattle flopped out of hiding into their path and ratcheted off two shots with his flechette. Kalia's shield stopped the first, and the second blew up against the deck. Derren's shield saved his legs and groin from the deflected splinters of shrapnel. Firing from behind his shield, Kalia slew the Luxattle with a burst of shots. His attitude towards the boarding shields warmed slightly. In the enclosed space of boarding action, the danger of deflection shots was dramatically increased. More gunfire streaked their way. Kalia saw what Cowber had spotted. Sally ports had opened on the far side of the depot chamber. Heavy trapdoor hatches concealed along the welded line where the bulkhead wall met the deck. Arch-enemy troops were clambering out of them, firing as they came. Kalia wasn't sure if the hatches had been deliberately designed for defensive actions, or if the enemy was making smart use of engineering crawl spaces. All he was sure of was that they were suddenly taking heavy fire against their left flank. The enemy troops were big, human males. Their battle dress was not uniform, but it was all the same general mix of richly ornamented armour plate and yellow breeches and coats. Boots, gloves, belts, armour clasps and bindings, along with packs and webbing, were made of a dark, rich leather, polished a caffeine brown like mahogany. The leatherwork, especially the wide and heavy waist belts, was interwoven with purple silk bindings and a silver wire stitching. The yellow of the material under the brown leather war gear was hot and acid, like a fusion beam. The warriors had tight, buckle-on metal helmets covered in brown leather that had incorporated visors. Narrow, single-lens oblong frames that covered both eyes and emitted a dark blue glow. The buckled chin straps of the helmets, fashioned from the same dark brown leather as the belts and webbing, were oversized and designed in the form of life-sized human hands that covered the entire mouth area below the nose. Kolia knew what he was seeing. Servants of the wretched Anarch, whose voice drowns out all others, demonstrated respect for their master by covering their mouths. These warriors were sons of Set.